Anne Bryan.
Catherine Hall.
Hardy Mosley Schmidt.
Joyce Williams.
Lillian Robinson.
Marilyn Nevels.
Johnny Mae Williams.
Donna Bennett Johnston.
Two residents were out looking for their lost dog on Ben Hur Road between Nicholson and Burbank this morning when they spotted what looked like the body of a woman lying in the drainage ditch on the south side of the bridge. Cause of death? Strangulation.
There was a jacket covering her right arm, and upon removing that, it was discovered then that the suspect had severed and taken her arm from the elbow down, which was not located here at the crime scene.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clementi, former New York City prosecutor, retired FBI profiler, and writer-producer on CBS's Criminal Minds. And today we're really happy to have, back in the studio,
Laura Richards, who's also very pleased to be back in sunny LA and back with the team. Real Crime Profile team, you rock. So advocate, analyst, author, and founder and director of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for Criminal Minds and Criminal Minds Beyond Borders, and I have a real interest in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes. So yes, Laura is back. She has brought me a fresh package of hobnobs. You all will be relieved to hear.
Chocolate hobnobs. Chocolate hobnobs. Just any old hobnob.
That's right.
And mini eggs, a little supply.
And mini eggs, thank you.
Got to keep Lisa Z happy.
That's right.
Well, it's great to have you back, Laura. It's great to have the team reunited. And why don't we start off with some listener questions and comments?
Yes, that's right. So I'm going to have to preface this a little bit.
Okay.
That I'm going to call this listener Emma. And Emma is a longtime listener. She's very supportive of our podcast, et cetera, et cetera. And she sent me, we had a back and forth exchange yesterday that got a little interesting. And I just want to hear what your reaction is to what she has to say.
Okay.
I know. This is like a big wind up. All right. Listen, I don't think I need to tell you this. I think you know already, but you insist on putting down people who use the name of the killer instead of the name of the victims. I don't have a problem with wanting to honor the victims, but geez, please stop acting like you're saints and the rest of us are sinners because we know Ted Bundy but can't name who he killed. I enjoy your show and I overlook some of the things I don't enjoy, but I don't like being put down. I just want to talk about her point of, do we do that? Do you think that we put down people, you know, for not knowing the names of the victims, and are we blaming people who are listening?
No, the whole reason for our podcast is to educate people about the names of the victims, because they never get promoted on TV or the radio or whatever. So that's all. We're not putting people down because they know the offender. We're just not giving the offender any more light of day.
Or airtime or airspace. And, you know, I've just literally run a training session in London talking to police and others in my session. And actually, all of them in the class agreed. All my slides show the faces of the victims and not of the perpetrator, because we do think they get memorialized. And a lot of them are seeking attention and they're looking for that platform and
the
want the notoriety.
Right.
And in fact, we're going to talk about
where
that's exactly what he wanted, and he had a God complex. So it's much more about, you know, when we think about cases, people do tend to think about the perpetrator, and it's their face and their name that comes into people's minds. And we want to correct the balance or redress it,
right,
and make sure people understand who the victims were who were targeted, get out of the blame storming and, you know, blaming victims for, well, what did they do? Where did they go? What did they wear? Who did they speak to? You know, this kind of culture. And really understand the victimology. And that's a really important part of both what Jim and I do in our professional every day.
Right. And the thing is, for our listeners, just so you understand the genesis of that, is that these are how the cases come to us. Victims get killed. We learn about the victims. Victimology is the first thing that we look at. We learn everything we possibly can about the victims, because it reflects back. The victim choices reflect back on the offender. And that's one of the first steps in profiling an offender. But the entire case, up until there's an arrest made and a conviction, is about the victims for us. That's all. We're not blaming people for knowing names of the offenders. These offenders should be vilified. These offenders should be understood, right, so that we know why they're doing what they're doing, how they're doing what they're doing, so that people can protect themselves from people like this.
And also, law enforcement can get into intervention and prevention.
Right.
And that's a really important part, which Jim and I learn from those cases. You know, how do you, understand risk? Like if it's a domestic violence case on a continuum. And so we create risk toolkits. And right, it is about education and awareness and trying to get better at what we do as well.
Yeah. I mean, and Emma, I don't know what particularly made you feel like we were blaming people for knowing the offender's names. We're just simply taking away the power of the offender by not naming the offender, by not saying their names. A lot of times the media will come up with scary monikers for these guys and men and women. And
some of them give them to themselves as
right,
well, don't
that's
they? Jim
right,
and I know a number of cases where they gave their own nickname, and that's what they were seeking, is
right,
the attention, and then the media perpetuate that.
And we saw it most strikingly in cases of school shootings and active shooter cases where the offenders would try to outdo the previous offender by doing something bigger and badder. And so the fact is that as we memorialize those cases by talking about the offenders over and over again, we actually empowered the next generation of offenders to try to do worse. And so this is something that the entire body of forensic psychologists and profilers and professional criminal investigators came up with as a way to try to undermine that, preventing them from stoking the fire of the next offender. So it's really a crime prevention thing. That's why we're doing it. And we hope that by learning who the victims are and learning about the victims and what they went through and how some of them survived, we hopefully will educate the public so that they too know that if they get in the clutches of one of these serial killers, that they don't necessarily have to die, that there are ways that people have found to survive those encounters, to tell us about them. And we hope that we can help prevent horrible rapes and murders because of that.
And we don't want victims written out, you know, or mm-hmm, written as footnotes in their own murders. So conversely, when we have a case, or certainly when I work cases of stalking and domestic violence, we want to keep someone alive, the victim. Their voice is at the centre of the risk assessment. We need to understand the perpetrator. But this is really a part of who Jim and I are as professionals. And we bring into this room, you know, the recording studio, when we talk about cases, our professional sense of self as well. So this is us being authentic too in who we are and what we do. So I'm not sure about this kind of us acting holier than thou or,
yeah,
you know, it that kind of feels that she's coming from a place that, of her own experience. And, you know, maybe we didn't explain as well as, you know, we should have why we have taken that approach to our careers. I mean, for me, it is the victim's voice, which I always say is the central sort of thread and strand that runs across everything that I do, whether it's talking on a podcast, whether it's analysing cases, whether it's training professionals, whatever it might be, it's still that central tenet that runs through of honouring people's lives. You know, and being respectful to the victims and learning from their deaths and trying to create risk toolkits and limit the space for action for the perpetrator and their name being out there.
And I definitely, I'm glad that you've addressed this, and that's certainly how I addressed it in our email exchange. But I want to give, I want to say something about, I don't think it's wrong to be fascinated with, you know, these perpetrators. I know there is a fascination with the darkness and that psychology, and I don't think people should be ashamed of being in just the interest in it. But what we are trying to do is swing that pendulum back to honor the victims and know about them. So
and the interest side. I mean, of course, you know, I've got a number of psychology degrees. You know, Jim uses his degrees and his experiential knowledge, and of course, we want to understand the psychology and the psychopathology, and you have to understand both sides. And certainly in our professional careers, that's, you know, what we do. So they're two different things, actually.
Sure.
One is about giving someone oxygen, time and space and memorialising them by keep talking about who they are and forgetting the victims. And the other part is actually understanding the psychology and psychopathology of how they became who they were and what they did and how they did it. And then we try and use that information and education and awareness to try and prevent, you know, at one end. You know, when people get the propensity to become violent, it's from 0 to 3 years of age. So, you know, looking in terms of the psychological autopsy and understanding those risk factors and protective factors. So there's much more to it. But I think they're two slightly different things, actually.
Right. And I think also you talk about the fascination that some people have with these killers. And I believe that that is the primitive part of our brain trying to gather information so that, that we can protect ourselves and others. I believe it's why we can't look away from a bad accident. The whole rubbernecking phenomenon is you can't turn your head away from it. You're drawn to it. And I think that's also why the vast majority of listeners and watchers of this kind of show on TV or in movies or in other media is because women naturally have protective personalities. They want to care for the people they know and love. And I believe they take in this data because it's valuable information to them. It helps them learn how to avoid this for their own families and friends.
No, I never thought of it that way. That's great. Okay, so Emma, there you go. I hope that we answered your question. There's one more. Can we have one more?
Sure.
Okay. So this is from, let's call her Anna. She's a big fan of the podcast. Her question is, would it be possible for Laura or Jim to give any advice to women on what to do if they are ever abducted? I was once stuck in a fake minicab. We thought it was a legit one we had ordered as it pulled up outside the cab office we were waiting at. When the minicab driver let out my boyfriend and then drove off at a high speed and backwards with me in the cab, this was before everybody had mobile phones. Luckily, a police car with siren and lights happened to rush past not far from my home, and although it was entirely unrelated, it caused the cab driver to stop, at which point I got out and ran home. I tried to remember the license plate, but by the time I got home, I'd forgotten it, and the point was, while I was in the cab, not only did I kind of freeze, but I was racking my brain to figure out what my best strategy should be. I'd assume I'd be raped, but I didn't know what to avoid being killed. Should I comply? Struggle? Should I say I had a transmittable disease? Or would that mean I'd be more likely to be killed? It'd be great to get some advice. Best wishes and keep up the good work, Anna.
Well, Anna, that's a very good question and a very difficult question. There are a spectrum of different offenders. I will say the most basic truism about this is that if someone is trying to move you to a secondary location, the risk of you being hurt and or killed goes up dramatically. So anything you can do, even jumping out of a moving vehicle, is safer than going with someone to another location. You should kick and scream and bite and claw and poke eyes out and rip ears off and do everything you possibly can to get away from anybody who is trying to get you to another location, period. There is nothing you should do short of losing your life to get away from that person. And that's because it is such a grave risk. So that's the first thing you should know. Laura?
Well, I was going to say that actually I was on the plane coming back out here, and actually someone did disclose to me a very similar situation as to what has just been described. And actually it was this particular person, and I won't say who it is, of course, but she was in a taxi, and we have a very high-profile case at the moment going through the Royal Courts of Justice, a human rights case and a case about whether the Metropolitan Police failed because a taxi driver was picking up young girls and women outside of clubs and bars, and then he was driving them off and raping them. And this particular lady told me that she had managed to escape. And, you know, the police didn't come and talk to her until 3 months after, even though she did, after she had escaped, managed to flag down a police officer and tell him what had happened. But my question to her was, at which point did you realise you were in danger? And she said that when she got into his taxi, he started asking a lot of questions, and he was obviously trying to gauge how much she had drunk, where she was going, who was waiting for her. He was kind of compliance checking. And I said, so what was it about him? She said, well, it was when he offered me a glass of vodka. He was offering drinks, and he started to smoke. He lit up a spliff, and the interest that he was paying in her, everything, all her senses were saying, I've got to get out this taxi and I've got to do whatever it is to get out of here. And what she managed to do was convince him she needed to go to the toilet. And, you know, that she was so desperate she was going to wet herself. And actually, she did manage to get him to stop. But when she was out of the cab, he kept driving back and forth, coming back to see, mm-hmm. you know, what she was going to do next. And fortunately for her, there was a young Swedish student just stood by the side of the road, and she flagged him down, now quite hysterical, because she'd realised she had escaped something yeah. that was going to be quite serious. They spoke to a police officer, but the police officer was very dismissive, as if it was just a nothing. And I think everything that she was describing to me was about her instinct. Mm-hmm. And I always say, and we say it at Paladin, and, you know, we say it time and time again, trust your instinct.
Yeah.
If something feels wrong, it normally is. Whatever you have to do, as Jim said, whether you have to physically fight, you know, fingers, thumbs in eyes, whatever it is to not be transported from A to B, then do that. The flip side of that is every perpetrator is different, in the sense that, you know, I've certainly worked rape cases where with one victim, she wasn't physically and violently assaulted in her face, but another victim was, where she had to have facial reconstruction. So the police kept saying they're different, they've been attacked by different people. Mm. And I said, no, the compliance aspect is what's different. One fought back and the other one didn't. The one who didn't fight back, you know, did not need reconstructive surgery, and she was raped. And, you know, for her, that was her way of managing the situation, but she was taken at gunpoint. So we go again back to the issue that if someone's trying to transport you and they're using a weapon, and particularly a gun, you have, you know, a split second really to do something, you know, in terms of being able to get away. But the lady in the rape case who did fight back, you know, was in a very serious, she was still raped, but physically, you know, very seriously assaulted. So again, perpetrators will compliance check. And, you know, for victims, you really do have to trust your instinct, because every situation will be different, and yeah. a perpetrator will change their behaviour as well based on the way the victim reacts.
Yeah, there are different rapist typologies, and each one you have to deal with in a different way based on who that person is.
So the police kept saying, you know, thinking every time a victim was reporting, there's no way a cab driver would be responsible, because you have to go through the licensing process. Mm-hmm. But it ended up, Jim, in the hundreds of victims. You know, some, many of them had come forward. And so there were real challenges here. And it's really about rape, you know, in the round, in terms of police investigations, the standard of, you know, there's lots of cases where victims are coming forward and they're not being believed and cases aren't being investigated. And then you have a whole load who don't come forward. And I wonder whether this was reported or not from our listener, but it sounds like she certainly had a very lucky escape.
Definitely. Yeah. And what does it say that this, that Anna's, that Stryver, like, he didn't care that the boyfriend had seen him. I mean, you know, they...
Which is very risky behaviour, yeah. which says that yeah. he may well have done this, you know, numerous times before, because he feels that confidence.
And that he was planning on killing her. That seems to be pretty obvious. It's such high-risk behaviour that he knows that if she's alive, then he has a very good witness against him who can just talk to her boyfriend, who can fill in the other details, and the chances of him getting caught are very high. But there are types of rapists who are power reassurance rapists, and they literally don't have the confidence to date women, and so they use a weapon to threaten a woman to get her in a position where he can have sex with her, and in his mind he's actually dating the woman. That person will typically say things that are consistent with having a date. They typically won't use violence, and they will use violence to threaten to get control, but they won't actually use violence during the course. Of course, all rapes are violent crimes, but they won't use additional violence, and usually the weapon is only to control the woman. So they'll say things like, you know, you should lock your doors, you should get a dog to protect yourself, you should do other things, you know, to prevent this kind of thing. They'll say, was it good for you? Can I see you again? Things like that. I mean, it's really absurd, but that's what happens with power reassurance rapists. And with them, because they may have a weapon. The times when those cases have become fatal were ones in which either they were about to be discovered, so they killed the woman because they didn't want to be discovered, and sometimes because they didn't get compliance, they attacked violently. But then there's power assertive rapists and anger excitation rapists. Both of them are fairly violent. The anger excitation rapist is somebody who is extremely violent and almost always will kill you. And so it's a difficult thing to determine whether somebody's doing this to just hurt you, to punish you, or hurt you, to torture you and kill you. So if somebody starts out violent, chances are they're going to get more violent. And so, again, fight with your life to get away, because that you don't want to let that person take you to another location. Of course, always be secure in your homes, always be situationally aware. Those are things that you can learn yourself. You can take courses in how to deal with that. And there's a great book by Gavin De Becker, who's on the board of advisors for the Behavioral Analysis Unit.
And called I know, The Gift of Fear.
Yes,
mm-hmm. We mentioned that before, yeah.
He's written another book called Protecting the Gift, about how you can protect your children and loved ones. So The Gift of Fear would be a great book for people to read, because it teaches you how to go back and listen to your instincts. Your instincts are nothing more than all your senses picking up all the data, your subconscious crunching that data and telling you, this is a bad situation. Listen to it, because it's the only way you can protect yourself in this kind of a situation.
And 9 times out of 10, you know, certainly the rape statements that I've read throughout the course of my career, which has been in the thousands, that the victim did know the point that they were in danger, but they didn't listen to it for lots of different reasons. One of the main ones is that they didn't want to offend or upset that person. You know, they're walking down a street, a male's quickening their pace behind them, and instead of them crossing the road or starting to run, they stay in situ, you know, and don't get off the train. They don't want to upset somebody.
They don't want... It's politeness.
Politeness.
Yeah,
yes.
It's using somebody's good comportment, somebody's kindness, somebody not wanting to offend others against them. And unfortunately, forcing them into a situation where there's more and more and more risk, and then they just take over.
And then, you know, putting it back in context, because obviously this has come in from somebody's specific experience, but we've got to remember that about 80%, 80 to 90% of cases that we're talking about, they're actually people who are known, who are committing the rapes and the sexual assaults on the victims. So stranger rape, you know, is relatively rare. But of course, we want people to understand some of those risks, in terms of even little things. The amount of times I go running and, you know, I can run up behind somebody without them even knowing, because they've got their music on so loud that they're not situationally aware about what's going on around them. So, you know, I mean, I'm running because I'm physically training, but there's so many people in cities now who are plugged in, zoned out, looking at their phones, are just not aware of what's happening around them, or sitting in a taxi, not seeing little signs. So they're tuned out, and really you need to be present and tuned in to what's going on in your immediate environment when you're getting from A to B. So they're all little things, but there's no one... You know, one size fits all of always do this or always do that, other than being conscious of what's going on in your environment.
Yeah, by being situationally aware, then you'll be able to pick up the data that you need in order to make a decision in a split second, so that the chances of you getting attacked are going to be minimalized.
And realistically, that's all you get if you are grabbed. And the fight or flight reaction actually is one that is not processed at a conscious level. Which is another thing to say, you know, of how you would react. I hear often that people say, oh, if this happened, I would do X, Y, or Z. But actually, you know, that's why training, doing self-defense training, things that you're trying to create, you know, if you were grabbed, you've gone through that process a number of times in a training session, so it becomes much more as a natural response that you would fight or hit somebody in a certain points of their body. So in the throat, eyes, you know, certain areas that are much more vulnerable and much likely to give you a couple of seconds to be able to get out of that situation. But that's realistically all you have.
Yeah. And be vocal. tell people what's going on. Scream at the top of your lungs.
And scream fire. People are much more likely to respond to you screaming fire than anything else. And this is part of the bystander effect, you know, that people don't like to get involved when there's a situation unraveling in a public space and place. And Professor Simbardo, who I will talk about as a recommendation later on, but this bystander effect happens an awful lot, particularly in big cities. So you're far likely to raise the alarm or get a response from people by shouting fire, of people coming out to see what's going on and calling the emergency responses.
This was an 82-year-old woman who had been brutally, brutally attacked. And the things that had been done to her were unbelievable.
Police had no clue as to what any motive would be or why anybody would want her dead. It was a mystery at that time.
This next segment of our coverage of the Bayou killings is about a killer who killed at least 8 women that we know about, and we'll call him SG. This guy was a very heinous killer. I don't know how you felt about him, Laura, but I found his personality, his methodology, and the way he actually dealt with his victims to be one of the most reprehensible killers I've ever studied.
We want to warn people that there may be some graphic content to this particular pod, so just to warn you.
Yeah, certainly talking about, you know, what he did to the women that he targeted. And I think, you know, when we were talking earlier, we talked about, you know, people's psychopathology, and when you track his back and see some of the early life experiences, which are not an excuse for what he's done, mm-hmm. but they explain some of the things that he's done, but certainly targeting women and objectifying them in such a way in his fantasy and reality. So we're going to get into that. But I think, you know, at the start point of one of the victims, which, you know, we know that there are at least 8 of them across a 10-year period. And, you know, there's some interesting, what we would call hiatus periods in his, or the alleged hiatus periods, because we don't know for sure, but periods where he seemingly stopped offending and was sort of practicing and trialing different weapons of choice. So it was a very conscious process of what he was doing, and decided to use things in his everyday life like zip ties to be able to kill women. So I think, you know, we should probably start by talking about the first victim, Anne Bryant, who he targeted first off, who was actually 81 years of age.
81. Helpless in a nursing home.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just
vulnerable and almost, you know, a sitting duck to a stalker and a prowler and a predator like him, but really a case that should have been set off serious alarm bells right from the start.
Right.
Given that her situation, you know, being in the nursing home, which, you know, 81 and having been a mother and she was a grandmother, you know, really does the targeting here, and the fact that he was watching her and had been outside her window watching her, and goes into her, the place where she should be safest,
right,
and where other people are around too.
Right.
It's an incredibly high-risk situation, isn't it, Jim?
Absolutely. I mean, he started with what we see as one of the precursor crimes, voyeurism. He watched her. She was not bothering anybody. She couldn't have been more docile.
You know, she was an artist, musician. She liked playing bridge with her friends. I mean, just, you know, was living in the safety of this community. And
this gives us our first indication of the psychopathology of the offender. He is picking out a very vulnerable victim in a situation where she was completely helpless. He was exploiting her by voyeuristic crimes before he actually entered, and obviously she was a trusting woman. He tried her door and it was unlocked, and he just walked right in, and she was asleep.
Well, she kept her door open, actually, I read, because they would administer medication to her.
But, probably all were open. The nurses probably had to have easy access.
Which says, again, about the risk level.
Yeah.
You know, if people are going into, you know, the nursing staff, et cetera, going into their rooms, then this is a great risk. And the fact that he'd watched her have a bath and get undressed and he goes in there, not really being able to control the environment, but feeling confident enough. Or maybe he doesn't really know what he's going to do, Jim.
Right, he's certainly taking a tremendous amount of risk. So what does that tell us? It tells us that the desire, this need-driven desire that he has is very, very strong, that he's willing to do this. And it also tells us that he has absolutely no compunction about doing anything he wants to another human being. And I think this is going to play out over and over and over again in his crimes.
And we did, just to say, this was a case that we did cover on the show that aired in, which year was it now, Jim? 2014,
I think.
Killer Profile.
Yeah, on Lifetime Movie Network. And you can see episodes of that on YouTube and on Lifetime Movie Network, their website.
So we spent a lot of time researching it, but also listening to him on interview. And although we don't want to give oxygen or airtime in terms of giving a platform, actually some of the things that he says that he did or didn't do are kind of interesting discussion points when we think about, you know, what we know about what happened and what he was seeking to achieve. And certainly his version of events is that he went in, he wasn't sure he was going in to rape her. And as he grabbed her, she then started to scream. But putting this again in context of that was what he said, but when we understand that he actually stabbed her in excess of 50 times, both sort of perimortem as well as postmortem, where he continued to stab her. And again, this is where it gets quite graphic, but he almost decapitated her and disemboweled her. So this was a very bloody and violent crime scene with a very defenceless 81-year-old woman who was fighting for her life but was vulnerable in every way. I mean, in terms of her strength and her ability, and he has a weapon. So that, again, the sense that he went with a knife.
Yeah, what was his real intention? He obviously could have overpowered her. She was 81 years old. She was asleep. He got into her room without waking her, and he decided to attack her. He didn't go in there with intentions of being a nice guy. He went in there, he's cold, he's calculating, and incredibly goal-oriented. He no matter what his victims did, he always found a way to kill them very violently and then do what he wanted with them.
And he, just to cap it off, he left her body there. He didn't transport it anywhere. He left her there to be found.
He left her in situ, and she was found the next morning. So this would have been a very bloody crime scene.
Right.
You know, to be stabbed in excess of 50 times, and he left her in situ, and she's found by the nursing staff the next morning.
Mm-hmm.
And they raise the alarm. But, I mean, this kind of crime, you know, at this time, in this place, the location, it being a nursing home, and just the way that she was killed, should have really rung serious alarm bells to law enforcement.
Yeah.
And they should have been on, you know, red alert in terms of this was an individual who would absolutely, if he hadn't done this before, would do this again, and
yeah,
should be investigating this case as a highest priority.
Yeah, absolutely. And they may have, but the next known kill by this offender was 5 years later. And I think it just sort of faded away into the backdrop. After they didn't resolve it right away, it just became sort of another one of their cold cases. And unfortunately, that allowed him to go on and kill and kill and kill and kill. It's just horrible because he was so violent and so incredibly disrespectful to people. But I think this sort of started off his murdering career, and he would learn from it.
But of course, he had been offending before.
Right.
You know, the gateway offences, stalking, being a voyeur, all these other things that he was doing, and viewing pornographic material, very violent pornographic material, and, you know, peeping on and stalking lots of women. But in terms of the murder, it's the first one that we're aware of. And as Jim said, there was this, you know, supposed alleged 5-year hiatus where he is actually practicing across that time methods of kill. So,
and fantasizing too, I'm sure.
Absolutely. And, you know, whether the fantasy and reality were two different things in this situation, I think part of it was about him learning, you know, the her screaming loudly and all the things that he thought would happen probably happened quite differently in reality. And he was someone who was trying to look to limit, you know, obviously being caught. He had no intention of being caught. But in that time, he also, in those 5 years, started a relationship with someone called Terry.
Mm-hmm.
And she becomes significant in a sense because she is almost the smokescreen for him, the distraction of him in this relationship. And I think the relationship is quite significant in many senses and acts as a little bit of a protective buffer for a while, or a protective factor. But of course, this need-driven behaviour and the fantasy, you know, becomes too much. So,
we should remind people that we are still talking about the Baton Rouge area, where from our last few pods, we were talking about a totally different serial killer, DL, who is operating at the same time.
Right.
And I think that led to probably a lot of confusion as far as...
Well, I mean, SG did actually watch the news, followed and tracked DL's progress, kind of was jealous of the coverage that he got and so forth. But the fact is that he took advantage of that. And there were times when he kind of sat back and just probably relished what DL was doing. The relationship that he had with Terry not only provided him with sort of a cover and a mask of respectability, it also provided him the opportunity to go out and kill, because Terry would work overnight. So that meant he was free to roam at night. And then he would pick her up during the day and bring her home. Many times he'd be disposing of bodies on the way to pick her up.
And had bodies in the car when he had picked her up.
Yeah.
I mean, this is really quite unbelievable in the sense that, you know, he understood risk to a degree, but he also really did, you know, push the envelope in terms of having women in the car or in the boot, you know, and we'll talk about each case. But a lot of this was very high risk behaviour.
Mm-hmm.
But then he was looking at things that would make the kill much more efficient. And we know, you know, through some of the things that he was doing, it wasn't necessarily about the kill part. It was about what he wanted to do with the victims thereafter. But I think the relationship, I had a very keen eye to understand, you know, what was happening in that relationship with Terry. And as Jim said, she did actually get him a job at the convenience store that she worked at, but they were like two ships that passed in the night, which suited him absolutely down to the ground, so that he could do what he really wanted to do. You know, how well did Terry actually really know him in the relationship?
Well, she said that he really didn't want to engage in sexual activity with her, and she first thought that was because of her, something was wrong with her. And then he said, no, I just think it's dirty, it's nasty. So she thought, oh, well, he just doesn't like to have sex. And that was it. Well,
but she seemed very happy with him. She never reported any domestic violence or ever would have suspected that he was violent, which is interesting because you pointed out in the DL case that he was, you know, abusing his wife and was violent towards other people. Yeah. So it's just interesting.
That- yeah, well, this is what we were talking about earlier. There is a spectrum of offenders, and this guy is much more of a Jekyll and Hyde offender. He was charismatic, engaging, and he knew how to be polite and all that. But that's all an act. That's completely mimicking behavior, something that he didn't feel at all. Yet he was able to convince people that he was a nice guy. And those are some of the most dangerous offenders. In this particular case, the psychopathy level of this guy is off the charts. He really enjoyed what he was doing. And we'll see in some of the cases where he mocked the victims and where he mocked law enforcement, and his entire reason for doing this was to satisfy himself. He had absolutely not a scintilla of empathy or care about the people whose lives he was taking very brutally.
And people were there for his entertainment and for his control. And that, again, understanding the relationship of what Terry brought for him, what she brought was he looked legitimate in this relationship, and it was a smokescreen and a cover. And actually, Terry posed no problem to him or no risk. He controlled her. He didn't need to do anything to her. You know, he had his life mapped out in a way that actually it went to clockwork of him using his time, her being at work, her never questioning him, her never sort of pushing him to come to bed with her at a certain time or to really do anything. So there was never a need for him to be violent to her. He controlled her in a different way. Mm. And I think that's another interesting aspect of this. But what she did was test him when they first got together. And she kind of pushed his buttons to see whether he would be physically violent to her, because she had a past history in abusive relationships. And when he didn't react, she thought, this guy must be a good guy because he didn't raise his hand to me. And that cemented the relationship to her. But of course, in terms of who he really was, he wasn't into just having normal sex. It had to be very violent sex, but he also wanted to spend time with somebody who wasn't engaging or interacting. He didn't want to have that level of intimacy or interaction. And that's what we're going to talk about, that psychopathology. Right. So actually, Terry gave him a lot of things that enabled him to carry on and to be this person kind of behind closed doors in a different way. He had this legitimacy and this mask in a very different way.
So we'll next talk about necrophilia and maybe some of the things psychologically that help that develop in this particular offender.
It's a city's worst nightmare. It's an investigator's worst nightmare to know that you have a person that's going around doing these type of horrendous acts to innocent female victims, and what he's capable of. This sick individual is preying in our community, preying on innocent females. So you're thinking, okay, when's the next victim going to happen?
So Laura, one of the things that we should do is discuss the things like the necrophilia that this particular offender exhibited. It's a paraphilia.
And not many people know what a paraphilia is or even what necrophilia is. So we should definitely discuss that in much more detail in maybe the next pod.
Yeah, as we get into the sort of extremes of his behavior with the different victims, I think we're going to find a whole bunch of paraphilias that he exhibited that are going to be quite disgusting.
They are. I mean, they're not easy to certainly understand, but when you're exposed to what some offenders do, you know, and we will have to discuss just some of the detail of that, because there was cannibalism here as well. There was a whole spectrum of things that, you know, we would put under the umbrella of a paraphilia.
So before we go, do you guys have any recommendations?
I definitely have one, because I've been listening to a lot of other podcasts as well, being in London. And there was certainly one that I think is great. And I know you like it too, Lisa.
I do, absolutely.
Which is The Tim Ferriss Show.
Oh, yeah?
Have you listened to it at all, Jim?
I haven't yet.
I think you would enjoy it.
Yeah, I think you'd really like him.
I mean, he basically has on lots of very interesting guests and people. He looks for patterns, a bit like what we do, Jim, you know, but he looks for patterns of successful people. So he gets on all these incredible people from different industries who have done amazing things. And he asks very intelligent and smart questions about, you know, their day to day. What do they do in the morning? How do they structure their work-life balance? How did they come upon the thing that they're doing? Mm-hmm. And, you know, it really, he asks great questions, I have to say, as an interviewer. They're super intelligent, high in EQ, high in IQ, and the people he gets on. There was one in particular, the last podcast I listened to, which he had on Professor Phil Zimbardo.
Mm-hmm.
Does that name ring a bell to you?
Yes, it does.
What context does it ring a bell?
Well, I mean, he's one of the great thinkers in psychology, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, he's 82 years of age now. sharp as, you know, a tack, and just his incredible wealth of knowledge, but his clarity and his vision and the work that he does is just so fascinating. From, you'll recall, the Stanford prison experiment that he did,
right,
which was in 1971.
Right.
And, you know, he wanted to understand psychology and what people's decisions and what would make people do bad things.
Right. And if our listeners aren't aware of that, what he did was basically take a group of students and made half of them prisoners and half of them prison guards. And he found that very quickly the population, the part of the population, although it was mixed, the part of that population that became prison guards very quickly became sadistic towards the prisoners in their care. They just looked at them, they objectified them, they thought of them as lesser than them, and then they started treating them very badly.
And he was observing it 24/7, this experiment, and he actually had to shut it down because the behaviours became so cruelly intentioned. And he gives some insight about what happened to himself as sort of the superintendent of the prison, that actually he became part of the system. Mm. So there's some fascinating insight, not just about the experiment that he ran that he ended up having to shut down because it became so dangerous and risky, but also just his own insight about, you know, his girlfriend challenging his behaviour, which I thought it was amazing that he shared. So I don't want to ruin it for people to listen to, but he also poses the question of what pushes some people to become perpetrators of evil, and yet other people act heroically and heroically on behalf of those other people in need. So, you know, he talks about the bystander effect and the origins of evil, and it really is one of the most fascinating podcasts that I've listened to for a while.
Wow. So it's called The Tim Ferriss Show?
The Tim Ferriss Show. And that particular one was Professor Phil Zimbardo.
Okay, great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just want to support Tim's show, too. It's wonderful, as Laura said. And not only he interviews people who have succeeded, but not just monetarily, you know, succeeded in all different ways, whether they're athletes or great thinkers or actors. So I really want to recommend it, too. And also, if you want to see a film depiction of the Stanford Prison Experiment, that came out, I think, last year, maybe there was a movie about it. So you can rent it and see what you think.
I think it's a very interesting principle because it kind of it can apply to sort of law enforcement, any kind of environment where we're not just talking about the individual level, we're talking about the group level, the group think, and also the system or the environment that people are in. And it's just such a fascinating, you know, once you get into why he did it and how he did it and just the challenges of running that kind of experiment, but in a psychology, in a university, but monitoring it 24/7. He talks about the logistics of it, too.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds great.
Yeah. I have a little different type of recommendation. And this comes from the fact that I was speaking at YPO in Vancouver a couple weeks ago. And
YPO, Jim?
YPO is Young Presidents Organization. It's a worldwide organization. You won't find much about it on the net because they're very sort of advertising averse, publicity averse. But it's leaders from business and world leaders around the world, all who have attained a certain level by the age of 35. And so they're young thinkers and movers. And one of the speakers that really made the most impact on me was Justin Trudeau, Prime Minister of Canada. Wow. And his father had been the Prime Minister. His mother had also spoke at this conference. But the thing that Trudeau told the group that really stuck out to me was that the first thing he did in his cabinet was make sure it was 50-50 male-female. How can you possibly represent a country when you don't represent them in the people that you surround yourself with? And so he completely valued the perspective of women. And they're undervalued in politics. They're undervalued in business. So he brought that in immediately. And everything that he said just was so common sense and plain speaking. And he's so human that I would recommend our listeners find any speeches that he make and follow him, because I really think that he is an incredibly gifted leader, and I really wish he could be the supreme Allied commander of the world, because he really has an amazing, inclusive way of governing that I think should be modeled around the world.
That sounds great.
It does. Sounds fascinating. Certainly, you know, in England and Wales, in our parliament, it's not reflective in the same way. And for him to make that conscious decision right from the start. I mean, I want to say, oh, that's incredible. Wow, that's amazing. But it should just be a standard in boardrooms, in, you know, why we're still at that stage where we think this is kind of, you know, something that we have to hold up and say this is fantastic and incredible, but it should just be a standard.
Isn't that what Ruth Bader Ginsburg says when she's asked, you know, how many women should there be on the Supreme Court? So she always says, nine. There should be nine women on the Supreme Court. Why not? You know, what kind of question is that?
I mean, for many decades, there was nine men, right?
Exactly.
So...
All right, guys, great to have you back. And we'll see you next time on Real Crime Profile.
So if you enjoy our podcast and would like to support us, there are a couple of important things you can do. First, you can go over to iTunes and give us a positive 5-star review. You can check out our sponsors and take advantage of the special promotions for Real Crime Profile listeners. You can go over and like our Facebook page, and you can follow us on Twitter. But most importantly, you can share our podcast with friends, family, and anyone you know would be interested in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes. So thank you for listening.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineered by Terrell Parham. Music composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, safety, shelter or counselling, call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, 214-946-4357, or go on their website, www.genesisshelter.org, or the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.
If you're a regular listener to the show, you know we have great brands like Blue Apron, Audible, and Casper advertising with us, and they keep coming back because our listeners really respond to them, which we're really thankful for. Well, if you happen to own a business or manage the advertising buy for one, then you should consider advertising on Real Crime Profile. Podcast advertising is on the rise, and it's one of the most effective ways of reaching consumers on the go today. So please go to Wondery.com/advertisers. Again, it's Wondery.com/advertisers. And get in touch with us. Thanks.